Hello and welcome to another episode of Such Stuff, the podcast from Shakespeare's Globe. This week we're back with another episode of the Shakespeare Diaries. Every fortnight, actor and Shakespeare's Globe artistic director Michelle Terry sits down with actor Paul Reddy to discuss a different Shakespeare play from isolation. This week, in celebration of the upcoming summer solstice, we turned our attention to A Midsummer Night's Dream. As ever, in advance of this episode, we collected questions from you, our wonderful audience, to put to Michelle and Paul. Thanks again for the fantastic array of questions. Next time, Michelle and Paul will be discussing Love's Labour's Lost, so do keep an eye on social media and send in your questions. Now, back to the riotous magic of A Midsummer Night's Dream. Michelle starred as Titania and Hippolyta in our 2013 production of A Midsummer Night's Dream on the Globe stage. And alongside listening to this episode, you can watch that 2013 production with Michelle on YouTube for free until Sunday the 28th of June. The breadth of this play and its sheer scope is so extraordinary, and Michelle and Paul's discussion ranged from climate change and chaos in the cosmos to the relationship between jealousy and power and the pervasive idea of capture that spans the play. Over to Michelle and Paul.
Hello, my name's Michelle Terry.
My name's Paul Reddy.
And today we will be talking to you about A Midsummer Night's Dream. Have you ever been in A Midsummer Night's Dream, Paul?
No, I've never been. Never been in A Midsummer Night's Dream.
There's a running
actually, what
theme
I did,
now.
What I did forget was that I have actually been offered twice to be in A Midsummer Night's Dream in my life, and both times I've turned it down.
Interesting.
Puck.
What?
Don't worry about it. Puck and Lysander.
Okay, let's start there. Why did you turn it down?
But I also want to say, before you get on to me about this, it has been one of those plays, I think, in my life that I thought, I just never want to see it again. I never need to see it again. I've seen it so many times. And then I watched the production you did at the Globe, and I was blown away by that. It was so powerful and so good and spoke to me in a way that it hadn't spoken to me before, that it completely changed my view on it. And then there was a year, which was last year, there were 3 Midsummer Night's Dreams.
Mm-hmm.
And I saw them all within like 2 weeks of each other. And they were all really good and really interesting.
And all really different.
Really different.
I know. And I think there is something. And I remember when that 2014 production, and likewise, I was like, oh, Midsummer Night's Dream. Like, what am I going to learn from doing that one? I know that one. That's the one with the fairies and all the magic. And like you said, then you start to read it and you're like, I think there's a question about the darkness is there, about the play.
I'll read you the question. There's also this question. There's 2 questions here. First, about the popularity of the play.
Yeah.
What is it about the idea of Midsummer's Eve and the mischief and the madness that plays out that you think so appeals to audiences? It's always a hugely popular play. Why is the play so popular?
Yeah.
Okay, and here's the other question I think you were pointing at. Dream is often pitched as light-hearted and whimsical, but between the captured Amazonian queen, a daughter threatened with nunnery if she doesn't marry her father's choice, drugging and sexual harassment and use of misogynistic and racist language towards women, what's your view of the dark side of the dream?
Let's think about why last year might there have been 3 versions of A Midsummer Night's Dream? The country was in crisis, Brexit was happening, fracture was happening. There's no doubt that there was a clear, like, if you put dream in the title and you put midsummer in a title, it sounds expansive, it sounds transformative, it sounds light. It's the one that you think you know. And it does end, the thing you remember is the end. The thing you remember is a sense of unity, give me your hands if we be friends, and Robin shall restore amends. It ends with the fairy grace and blessing this place. You are left with a feeling that even though you have been through something traumatic, there is a healing that comes out at the end of it. So I think, yes, the journey of the play takes you to the most, like, if you're going to do this in reality, I mean, the Queen of the Fairies gets drugged, somebody gets turned, like the bestial transformation of Bottom and this relationship between a queen and a donkey, the darkness of the patriarchy, the abuse of power, the misuse of power. As somebody said, there's the use of racist language in the play. And it kind of, he throws, everything is thrown up in the air. But it doesn't head to a place of whimsical, or for me, it doesn't head to a place of whimsical, fantastical unity. I do feel like there is some kind of, whatever happens by the end, we'll never know. For example, when Titania wakes up from having been drugged, and she turns to Oberon and says, "Tell me how it came this night that I sleeping here was found with these mortals on the ground." And then they go. We never know what that conversation was. We never know whether he tells her the truth. We never know actually whether their relationship is all right, because the next time they see them, you're reminded of this elevated place of, we are their parents and original. We have to find balance. We have to restore some kind of balance, whatever fricture, whatever friction or fraction. I'm doing maths.
Whatever. It's not your strong point.
It's really not.
No, it's much better than my maths.
But whatever friction or fracture has happened, at some point there was a responsibility to find a way to reconcile across difference. And I think you are left with, that's the bit that's the memory for everybody. When you're watching the play or reading the play, that's what I was reminded of, was, yeah, that amazing speech by Titania about the seasons alter. This is the climate change speech, that the world is in chaos, cosmically, climactically. Is that a word? Climatically? Cosmically, ecologically, everything is in chaos. Domestically, the families are in chaos, the lovers are in chaos. And where are these two figures, these mythic representations of parents that go, we have to somehow find a place to find unity if we have any hope of balancing chaos and order. Like, I don't think there's any, just, and I know you're going to say something, and I'll just quickly finish this. I don't think, for me, the joy of it is it's so honest. He doesn't pretend that the world is full of really light fairy. I mean, Puck is not a nice fairy. He doesn't pretend that the world is just one single place of light. He balances light and dark. For me, the honesty is that the melancholy and the joy, the darkness and the light, the chaos and the order are always balanced, are always in opposition. And when they are out of balance, somehow he uses the play to restore balance again, but doesn't deny the existence of both sides.
That's really good.
Oh, thanks, Paul.
I think that's really good, really true. And also, I was interested in the fact that you said dream, like the idea that a dream appeals in it, perhaps in a time of chaos. And for me, the play has only become more relevant for the very reason you just said there about climate change and, you know, the dangers that are here, the catastrophe that is already here and happening and unfolding. Something that, this is all my kind of take on it, but, you know, we know something is happening in the world. We know something is happening to nature. It's obvious. We watch the news. We see the storms. We see the floods, the fires. And it speaks to me of kind of ignoring what our society does so well, is like stay on the surface. And because it has to, I suppose, like the economy is the surface. But underneath, there is the dream and the unconscious and the subconscious. And I feel, for me, the appeal of this play becomes that that is brought into the theatre in a very intriguing, mysterious, it starts to talk to those things that are within us as human beings that we can't focus on.
So this is the moment where Oberon and Titania meet, ill met by moonlight, proud Titania, what jealous Oberon. And throughout the course of the scene, they argue yet again. And Titania tries to explain to Oberon that they can't keep meeting like this, because every time they meet, they argue. And the more that they argue, their arguing is causing such profound dysfunction in the world, in the cosmos. Therefore, the moon, the governess of floods, pale in her anger, washes all the air, that rheumatic diseases do abound, and thorough this distemperature we see the seasons alter. Hoary-headed frosts fall in the fresh lap of the crimson rose, and on old Hyam's thin and icy crown an odorous chaplet of sweet summer buds is as in mockery set. The spring, the summer, the childing autumn, angry winter change their wonted liveries, and the mazed world by their increase now knows not which is which, and this same progeny of evils comes from our debate, from our dissension. We are their parents and original. And again, that goes back to that thing of how do we take responsibility for what is happening now? I mean, you can't not hear the idea that rheumatic diseases do abound without recognising the moment in time we are in a global pandemic of this silent killer. And as Paul said, we know about the floods and the fires, the childing autumn, angry winter, change their wanted liveries. It's hard not to hear the climate crisis that we are in now also being referenced in Midsummer Night's Dream through Titania. That line, we are their parents and original, what he doesn't say is, we are the gods and goddesses, we are the king and queen of the fairies. The status that he gives to Oberon and Titania is parental, and what it does is immediately make your responsibility for chaos domestic. The chaos that happens in the home is also the microcosm of the macrocosm and representative of the chaos that happens in the world, and often is what's so brilliant is what he doesn't say is, oh, it's somebody else's problem, someone else will figure that. Titania goes, we are their parents, we are the people, we have to take responsibility for this. So it's mythic and domestic all at the same time. He makes them parents.
Mm.
Like when I think about our responsibility as parents, it's not somebody else's responsibility to create adaptation, to create that hope. Like, we are responsible. And of course he plays on all those levels, because you've got the mythic level of Titania and Oberon, you've got the kind of mytho-historical level of Hippolyta and Theseus, and then this domestic level of Hermia playing the relationship out with her father, or the lovers playing their relationship out with each other. And then there's, whether you think it's the underworld or wherever these fairies exist, these otherworldly creatures.
You can tell me whether this is right or not, but like, a lot of it is moving around the idea of jealousy and eros, you know?
What do you mean?
Well, I mean, Michelle, I refer to what jealous Oberon.
Oh, yes.
No, but there's jealousy, but like...
And what, jealousy of the Indian boy.
And then the jealousy between the lovers of who has Hermia's love.
Yep.
Like very, very human, but very, very powerful emotion, jealousy. Disgust.
Yeah, I don't think I've actually thought about... Yes, well, what is the consequence of the green-eyed monster? And in this play, it plays out in quite dark ways. You're right, there is something around jealousy, but then because I'm also going, there's also something around power. Maybe there is something in the jealousy and the power play between Hippolyta and Theseus. I mean, Oberon is certainly jealous of Titania's relationship with the Indian boy.
I suppose what I mean by the... bringing jealousy into the room is, as I said, it's like a very human, that's very human, and it causes a lot of destruction. Love, which it also centres around, can be destructive in a way. Well, no, love, I suppose love is a, what can be done in the name of love is quite destructive. I think that's, it's interesting that you said power, because what do you do with jealousy? Do you try and get power over somebody because you are jealous?
Which is what plays out. Yeah. And that, and I'm just thinking about where the play begins. And what's hard for me is to remember how the the written play begins, because I do think there was something about that production that you talked about that framed, created a framing device.
I'd forgotten this, and I probably wouldn't have even been aware what was happening as I watched it. So this, I think, probably changed it a lot for me. Well, Michelle, what is it?
Because if you take the play literally, the play begins with the imminent marriage of Theseus and Hippolyta. They make reference to the fact that Hippolyta has been captured. You can't really ignore the fact that she says this night of our solemnities. The word solemn is in there somewhere. But it's all geared around what we would naturally assume is a marriage in our modern understanding is a union, a happy, chosen union between two people that love each other on whatever degree love they feel. But historically, there is an argument that audience would have absolutely known the Herculean, the feats of Hercules.
Yeah, the 12 labours.
The 12 labours, one of which was Hippolyta and her girdle. There's knowing that Hippolyta was the daughter of the god of war. You would have probably known that Hippolyta was a warrior, a leader of an all-female army. That is quite a lot of dense information that immediately elevates Hippolyta to a place of independence and supreme power. And what that framing thing was for the 2014 production was basically do what they do in Hamlet, was effectively do a dumb show, which was just to catch the audience up on what, just enough information to know what has happened before the play begins. So this battle between the sexes and then the capture of Hippolyta, and that within that capture, that is a really uncomfortable place to begin a play, and a really uncomfortable place to begin a play that is about relationships, union and
masculine feminine
power dynamics. So if you don't have that, the density of what those two figures represent, how the play begins is, now, fair Hippolyta, off we go to get married.
Now, fair Hippolyta, our nuptial hour draws on apace. 4 happy days bring in another moon. But oh, methinks how slow this old moon wanes. She lingers my desires, like to a stepdame or a dowager long withering out a young man's revenue.
4 days will quickly steep themselves in night. 4 nights will quickly dream away the time. And then the moon, like to a silver bow new bent in heaven, shall behold the night of our solemnities. If now fair Hippolyta is an active way of trying to communicate to someone that you have just beaten in battle and now captured, that's a very different transaction. So it felt important to that production to just frame the play in a different way. And of course, then you watch those power dynamics play out within a patriarchal system. Like, there's no doubt that, you know, Hermia is owned by her father. Yes, so where does jealousy sit within that power and the need to reclaim power when you feel like you have been disempowered? So Oberon somewhere feels disempowered by the relationship Titania has with her. There's a relationship that she has with another woman and has promised to look after and has the custody of this child. There's no doubt that Oberon is playing something out and he feels disempowered. In order to reclaim power, he has to disempower Titania. Similarly with Theseus and Hippolyta, similarly with the lovers throughout the going into the woods. But yeah, jealousy and power.
It's interesting how he disempowers her.
Oberon?
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's not imprisonment, which is another... It's not capture. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Well, he drugs her. I mean, if you had the modern day parallel of Rohypnol, you know, it's pretty dangerous what he does to her. But with the consequence that, I mean, certainly, when it's some of the most beautiful poetic language when she speaks to Bottom about how much she loves him. But mind you, she captures him, doesn't she? She finds a way to. She talks about the ivy wrapping him in ivy so that he's only hers. Like, there is a possession that comes with that kind of love. It's not like a sort of, now you've said that, I sort of go, where in the play is love equal? Like, is he also looking at how a misunderstanding of love that is built on possession or ownership or power? Are there relationships in the play where the love is equal? Maybe Maybe the lovers by the end, they reach a place of equality, but even that's questionable, isn't it? This is just picking up on that idea of capture that we were talking about, the capture of Hippolyta by Theseus, the capture of Titania by Oberon with the drug, and this idea that Titania somehow also captures Bottom. She captures him with her love, like she falls in love with him at first sight, and she says, "I pray thee, mortal, sing again." And that word mortal is something that I think we've sort of skirted around by talking about earthly creatures, domestic creatures, your mythic creatures, but there's a very clear distinction between those, the gods, and then these mortals. Yeah, so she says, "I pray thee, gentle mortal, sing again." She says to him, "Thou art wise and beautiful." And he responds by saying, "If I had enough wit to get out of this forest or out of this wood." So he threatens to leave the wood. And Titania's response is, "Out of this wood, do not desire to go. Thou shalt remain here, whether thou wilt or no. I am a spirit of no common rate. The summer still doth tend upon my state, and I do love thee. Therefore, go with me." This idea that we've heard her in the previous scene sort of chastise Oberon for the fact that their relationship is causing destruction in the world. She has ultimate power over the seasons. And here now she is using her power, her capacity to control the seasons as an example that if she can control the summer, she can certainly control a mortal. And that whether he wants to go or not, she will use her power to keep him here. And actually, by the end of the scene, when she said to the fairies, "And fairies, take him away," she says, "Tie up my lover's tongue. Bring him silently." You know, this idea of capture that we've been talking about throughout the play, here yet again, Titania's way of keeping hold of the thing that she loves, having power over the thing that she loves, is by capture, is by tying him up and bringing him silently.
So this question, as with As You Like It, the characters retreat to the forest. What is it about the woods? Why does Shakespeare return his characters here again and again? What does it offer the characters in Dream? And we were just talking about being in the patriarchal system and Hermia being owned by her father. And then she goes into the forest, where the patriarchy doesn't exist in this world. Or does it? I don't know. So I'm going, here she is in society in a patriarchal world, but she disappears into the forest that Shakespeare uses again and again.
Mm.
Somewhere where the rules are different.
Well, they go into the wilderness, don't they? They go into the wild. And somewhere in the middle of these plays, a dissension into chaos occurs. And usually that is, he takes the characters out of the confines of their original setting, moves them into a wilderness, and then somehow returns them. Love's Labour's Lost, Comedy of Errors, it's not a pastoral comedy. Early comedies, but they don't go, he hasn't picked up on the pastoral theme in these plays yet. They are still quite located in some kind of city, or the manor house in Love's Labour's Lost. He removes them into complete chaos or disorder, but he doesn't relocate them. And then suddenly, in, like you say, in As You Like It, something about what a forest represents, what the woods represent, that's the association with wilderness and darkness and danger, like what lives in the woods, the beasts, it's something about it that's less known. So something fantastical about the woods, something that's not quite literal about the woods, something otherworldly about the woods that has a has the wild of the wilderness about it, where, as you say, all the rules, all the confines that we recognise in society or within the city walls or whatever it is, it's not recognisable. Suddenly all bets are off.
Well, I suppose a society and a city being a place where nature has been beaten back and built on and is forever keeping, in order to have a society, forever keeping the chaos of human nature at bay. You know, have a police force, have the rules, have the government, whatever, you know, or everything that takes a society. And it's like, in order to make that society, we've had to build it. As civilization's grown, we've built it on nature.
Yeah,
but nature is always at the edge. And as soon as humans go, nature will just pop through. There's all those images of Chernobyl after the disaster and the people left and how nature reclaimed it. But it doesn't take long for nature to reclaim a city if humans go.
But also nature, you are reclaimed in nature. Like, just thinking about the question earlier about the cruelty of those lovers to each other. In the civil world, you probably wouldn't say some of those things, but suddenly you are at your most primal, most bestial, whichever way you say it. You become your most natural self, and that is equally as savage as it is civil. There's something about the unconscious, like needing to fall asleep, the lovers having to go back to sleep. And then when they wake up, there's that bit with Hippolyta and Theseus talking about being on the hunt. There's something about hunting that's also primal in all of us, like whether it's hunting for a lover or hunting the deer. I mean, that comes up in all of them, doesn't it? That's in Tame of the Shrew, Love's Labour's Lost, this one, that this idea that we are, in our nature, we are hunter-gatherers.
While you're on it, just a small thing that you told me that you'd read about the idea that we are naturally foragers.
Yeah.
Hunters, foragers. And the idea that, you know, living in cities, I don't know who wrote this, but now living in cities, the forager in us, having no place to go, goes to the shopping centre.
Well, yeah, right now. I mean, I'd love to know what the Amazon sales are in lockdown. It's like online, forage, what do I need? But the truth is we don't really need anything anymore because we're not, you know, we know where to get the berries and the leaves from. But
Aldi. Okay.
When Hippolyta talks about, I never heard so musical a discord, such sweet thunder. Like the idea of sweet thunder and musical discord, like constantly, yet again, it's this constant, everything's in opposition to each other, which I think is part of the appeal. And maybe in this play, because it is, the chaos is so out of balance, you cannot cut the savagery, you cannot cut the darkness out of Midsummer Night's Dream. There's something, again, so primal and animalistic about it. Like, he's constantly exploring, it feels like, and certainly in Dream, it's like unapologetically going, we are attached to the gods and the goddesses, we're attached to nature, we're attached to the earthly realm of whatever that, like, all I've got in my head now is foraging, people foraging in down aisles in Amazon. but our capacity, because it's still, that's also the meta theatrical bit, is it's still that amazing speech that Theseus has about our imagination. It's all made up. It's all reliant, totally reliant on the players and the audience engaging in an imaginative transaction. These people don't really exist. But what he puts on stage is your capacity. Like, I wonder when you watched the 2014, was that experience because the mythic in you was played out, the domestic in you was played out, the animalistic in you was played out, the primal in you was played out. He is just going, these are just actors playing out all of these different elements.
That's true, I was exhausted. No, but it is all those things. I think that's, without knowing why, I mean, I felt so not refreshed. I was invigorated and I felt a lot of powerful things watching it. And I think it's for all of those reasons.
And again, you go, but it's just a bunch of people in a space telling a story. Like, and And as you say, when it's done really well, you saw it three times in the space of 2 weeks. That I think there is something really transcendent and transformative, because transformation happens, doesn't it? You watch transformation play out when you're watching it. But it would be interesting, I have to find that in that Theseus speech about imagination, because where that comes in the play will not be an accident. So this is the speech that Theseus gives over midway through the play, where the dream has happened, everyone has woken up, and he gives this amazing speech about the imagination.
The lunatic, the lover, and the poet are of imagination all compact. One sees more devils than vast hell can hold. That is the madman. The lover, all is frantic, sees Helen's beauty in a brow of Egypt. The poet's eye, in fine frenzy rolling, doth glance from heaven to earth, from earth to heaven. And as imagination bodies forth the forms of things unknown, the poet's pen turns them to shapes and gives to airy nothing a local habitation and a name. Such tricks hath strong imagination.
Right, here is another question. The mechanicals are a bit of a Marmite bunch. What do you make of them and their role in the play? We don't need to answer this. We will not be forced to answer. because there, like, a lot of humour comes from the mechanicals. They're an incredible creation, I think, and that there is a lightness that they bring.
There is, but also, They are the every people. They are the people off the street, the local Amdram company that really wants to put on a play and really wants to impress people by putting on a play. It goes back to that meta-theatrical thing. At the same time as you've got gods and goddesses and these really cheeky, naughty, ethereal fairies and these warriors and huntress and Amazonian figures, all like really kind of huge ideas and representations, then you've got Tinker, Snug the Joiner. Like, he constantly reminds you, you are also these people too. You are also the people that like telling fairy stories to each other and like putting on costumes. It's like, and I think,
do you think they're the most human?
Yeah. And I think when they're done well, that is why you love them. Because most people will know someone that does amateur dramatics, you know, like,
but know someone who wants to play the lion too.
Wants to play the lion too. Give me the lions. Exactly, exactly. But they're not without myth. I mean, Bottom is like straight out of Ovid, what happens to Bottom. Like, that he gets transformed into a beast. The Pyramus and Thisbe, again, straight out of Ovid. They go to these mythic places. This idea that we're not all capable of living mythically or thinking mythically. I think they're the most beautiful tool of Shakespeare going. And they come in really late as well. Isn't it interesting? Right, here we are, however many minutes into this episode, and now we're talking about the mechanicals, exactly in the same way that he's gone myth, history, battle, and then goes dunk da dunk da dunk da dunk da dunk. Here we have people that just like telling stories, and not just like telling stories, they live for telling stories. They make their money out of telling stories, exactly the same way that the King's Men were doing at exactly the same time. It's so self-referential. That flute stuff at the end, that the thing about moonshine, and I was in I don't know how many performances of that show that I did, and I was always so, it was so moving, that bit, and hilarious. But it absolutely has to be done, and by being done well, I mean it has to be so painfully human. And I think that's the danger with those, is you sort of make them into these sort of commedia dell'arte caricature figures, when actually they've got to be the most human characters in the play. So that, if for an actor, that takes a stripping off of everything as opposed to adding on.
So a couple of questions to finish off. The character of Puck is one of Shakespeare's most distinctive, and puckish is a word that has passed into popular parlance, to describe certain characters or behaviours. What does the character of Puck and puckish tendencies mean to you? Is it an archetype Shakespeare is playing with, or something more specific?
Okay, so maybe this comes back to, why didn't you want to play Puck?
As an actor, it depends where you are in life, I think, as to what appeals to you, what you're interested in following. And I think certainly at the time, it didn't appeal to me. I didn't like spark anything in me to go, yes, I want to play that, or I need to play that, or I need to investigate that. And I think that's mainly how I've made decisions when I've been allowed. What I mean by allowed, because sometimes you take what you have to take things for different reasons, but when I have choice, that's the instinct I'm following. And I think Puck didn't light anything in me in those days.
Mm.
And the same with, and at the time, with Lysander, when Lysander was offered, I had a similar thing. And it also it depends what precedes. Like, what was I doing? And I can't remember now, but if I was doing it, it depends on what play I was doing before or what I was investigating before to what I then want to go and investigate afterwards. But also, having said that, like you said, when you started Midsummer Night's Dream, you weren't sure. You kind of went in with a bit of uncertainty about whether there was something that you wanted to investigate, and then you discovered something transformative. So I think sometimes entering into a play or a piece or a character with an ambivalence can lead you in really surprising ways.
Well, that's, yeah, because actually he does play with, when that's one of the things in the question is about what these are representations of. So you have some named characters like Helena, Hermia, Lysander, Demetrius. Then you have some that are clearly, like, Puck is a representation, or Bottom, Snug. There's kind of these fairy tale names that somehow feel like they could create a distance between you and them. But rather than getting to an idea of Puck, what is the Puck in you? And I think, when I think about, so the most recent one I saw was Sean's at the Globe, whenever it was, like 2019, where he had everyone play Puck. Like, the idea that we all have the capacity to, you know, be that puckish and that cheeky and that mischievous. And then the one that I remember where it was...
Trickster,
yeah. Yeah, and again, but those are representations, aren't they? They are, what are they called? Archetypes, right. But then I remember watching Jonathan Slinger's Puck at the RSC years ago, and it was, again, that lesson in going, oh, yeah, of course. In my memory, this may not be true, but in my memory, he was this really disgruntled, dishevelled, just this rebel, basically. And that famous line, I go, look how I go, was just like, I go, look how I go. Like, he was just so sort of annoyed and resentful of having to constantly be in service to this narcissist. That's a judgment. I don't know whether Oberon's a narcissist, but there's a...
Unbelievable.
But actually that, in having said that, that is a... How with 400 years of this play being in existence and it being the most popular play, the one that is done the most, it's really hard not to judge it. How do you not judge these characters? And I think Puck is one of those that we have so many ideas of what Puck could be. Of course we do, as we should, because it would be as many ideas as we have of Shakespeare or have of the characters that he writes, but how do you approach it so that it's the most, that where you and Puck and the Puck in you meet? Like, I wonder what your Puck would be like now.
I'm not showing you.
No, probably similar to Jonathan Slinger.
Right now, probably. Yeah.
That's it from us, but we'll be back soon with another episode of the Shakespeare Diaries. Michelle and Paul will be discussing Love's Labour's Lost, so if you have any questions to put to them, get in touch with us on social media and we'll pass them along. And in these unprecedented times, our doors are temporarily closed, but we are finding and creating new ways to stay connected and hopeful with you. As a charity that receives no government subsidy, we need donations to help us to continue to thrive in the future. Please donate what you can to help us explore how Shakespeare can continue to inspire hope and creativity. You've been listening to Such Stuff with me, Imogen Greenberg, Michelle Terry and Paul Reddy. To find out more about Shakespeare's Globe, follow us on Twitter, Facebook and Instagram. We'll be back soon with more stories from Shakespeare's Globe, so subscribe wherever you get this podcast from.